Play and stay on Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. Stand up paddleboarding, hiking, great restaurants and breweries. I'll tell you more about your next vacation destination later in the show.
Cairo, Seattle.
I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, a show about famous people and the stories behind the foods they love most. Today on the program, Michelle Zahner. Michelle has released two albums under the name Japanese Breakfast, and the song you're listening to right now is from her soon-to-be-released record, Jubilee. She is also the author of a new, very popular memoir called Crying in H Mart. The book is about her relationship with her mother, who died of cancer in 2014 when Michelle was only 25. But the book is also about food, specifically the Korean food that connected Michelle to her mother and to her culture. Do you think your mom would be surprised that you've gotten into cooking as much as you have?
Definitely. She would be really like weirded out by it, probably.
Her mom was Korean, and unfortunately, she passed away before Michelle had a chance to learn any of her recipes. But this is not an uncommon story. If you're the child of an immigrant, you may know that it is hard to wrestle these recipes from your parents and your grandparents because they don't write anything down, and they don't use measuring spoons or measuring cups. Melissa Miranda, chef owner of Seattle's modern Filipino restaurant, Musong, will join the show to talk about the project she did to trick these grannies into handing over their recipes.
In my family, my parents and my grandparents never measured anything.
Melissa will join us later in the show, but first, my conversation with Michelle Zahner. Michelle was born in Seoul, Korea, but she mostly grew up in Eugene, Oregon, with a Korean mom and a white American dad. But when her mom was diagnosed with cancer, she was living on the East Coast. So she moved back to Eugene to take care of her mom. And after she passed away, a lot of Michelle's memories were tarnished by that very traumatic time. But she managed to find peace and solace in a very unexpected place, the Korean grocery store, H Mart.
Yeah, so H Mart is a Korean grocery chain. It stands for Hanarim, which means roughly translates to one armful of groceries. And yeah, it was like, it just became like a real refuge for me and a really enjoyable place to get my groceries and kind of spark a lot of forgotten memories I had of my childhood and my mom. And yeah, you can get like all sorts of Korean side dishes there and, you know, instant noodles. And then there's also usually like a food court and like a Korean beauty counter and a lot of great groceries. I highly recommend it.
Have you actually cried in H Mart?
I cry in H Mart like all the time.
Aww,
I mean, not so much anymore, but I cried recently because, you know, sometimes you'll see Korean moms with their like kids going off to college and stuff, and they're like buying them groceries and stuff like that, and like escorting them along in the same way that I remember being in a grocery store with my mom, and that just wrecked me, you know.
When Michelle was a kid, every other summer of her childhood, she and her mom would spend 6 weeks in Korea staying with family. And eating was a huge part of these visits. Whether her aunts were ordering Korean Chinese delivery, or they were going out to eat, or someone in the family was cooking, these trips were partially designed to let her mother eat all of the foods she was homesick for. In the book, Michelle writes about one of these trips. She talks about arriving in Seoul late at night and not being able to sleep because of jet lag. And at 3 a.m, her mom suggested they get up and raid her sister's refrigerator. She writes, "At home, I was scolded if I got caught poking around in the pantry past 8. But in Seoul, my mom was like a kid again, leading the campaign. Standing at the counter, we'd open every Tupperware container full of homemade banchan and snack together in the blue dark of the humid kitchen. Sweet braised black soybeans, crisp yellow sprouts with scallion and sesame oil, and tart juicy cucumber kimchi were shoveled into our mouths behind spoonfuls of warm lavender kongbap straight from the open rice cooker. We'd giggle and shush each other as we ate with our fingers, sucking salty, rich, custardy raw crab from its shell, prodding the meat from its crevices with our tongues, licking our soy sauce stained fingers. Between chews of a wilted perilla leaf, my mother would say, "This is how I know you're a true Korean." You had a complicated relationship with your mom when you were younger, but food did bring you together. Can you talk about how you kind of got your mother and your aunt's approval early on?
Yeah. One thing that I love that's in the book is while I struggled to be good, I excelled at being courageous. And I think that that was a realization I came to pretty early on. My mom was very, you know, particular and could be very critical about things. And I was like a really rowdy tomboy. And so I really struggled to behave to her standards. But at an early age, I was a pretty courageous eater. And I remember trying a number of dishes that my mom was really surprised and proud of me having the sort of adventuresome nature to try. And I think that there were things that sort of, you know, as someone who's mixed race, like she could look at and be like, "That's how I know you're Korean. That's me in there," you know?
Yeah. What were the foods specifically that really impressed her and cemented you as a real Korean?
Yeah, so sannakji, which is in the book, is like live octopus. Koreans typically like really extreme foods. Like the soups are really scalding hot. And if something's meant to be cold, it's served with ice. And if it's spicy, it's really spicy. It's really red and flavorful. And so, you know, a lot of the seafood is like freshly killed. They like very live, fresh seafood. Yeah, the sannakji is this live, long-armed octopus that, you know, they cut the tentacles like pretty much right at the table and they're still pulsing. And so I was like maybe 7 or 8 when I tried that for the first time, and my relatives were very impressed with me. And that sort of set me on a path of you know, oh, I'll show you what else I can eat.
Do you feel like you do that even now when you're eating with friends in the States?
Yeah, definitely. I really pride myself in not having any dietary restrictions. And I pretty much like everything and have always been a pretty courageous eater, I'd say.
Could you just talk about your relationship with your mom through food? Maybe you could start with how your mom was so controlling about every meal that you had together.
Yeah, I think that might be like a specifically Korean thing, because like, I mean, I'm sure it's very present in other cultures and families, but in Korean food, like there's so many different ways you could eat a thing because there's so many side dishes and like sauces and like different ways that you can eat something and to create this like perfect bite. So I think everyone sort of has an opinion about what the best way to do that is. And so my mom would frequently sort of micromanage the way that I ate, like, "Oh, don't add too much of the sauce. It'll get too salty," or like, "Make sure it gets crispy," or "Ask for it this way. Don't cut the noodles. It's bad luck." So there's a lot of stuff like that in my culture.
Did it bug you or were you okay with it?
You know, as a child, it didn't bother me. But I think when you rot into a teenager and you start to hate like every normal thing that your parents do, yeah. It becomes irritating.
What would your last meal be?
There's a meal that my mom used to make for me every time I came home from college. I would fly home from Bryn Mawr College to Eugene, Oregon. And, you know, my mom would pick me up from the airport and then drive me like 30 minutes back home. And then she, you know, I remember just like sitting on the couch and my mom would just immediately get to work making the same meal that I look forward to every single time, and would bring all of the plates over to the coffee table and I would eat it on the ground, like watching TV. And like my mom would be behind me kind of like with her hand on my shoulder. And that's like just love and care, you know, like that's just, I miss that feeling. That's like what that tastes like to me, is like I'm being taken care of. When you're an adult and you don't have your mom anymore, no one does that for you again. She would marinate short rib like 2 days in advance and get this kind of kimchi that I love called dongjimi, which is like a white radish water kimchi. And she would cut up the kimchi and make sure that it was perfectly soured and like sat on the counter for a couple of days, so it was really extra fermented and tart. And she would cut up this like dongjimi radish, mix it with this brine, some red pepper flakes and sesame oil and sesame seeds, and then serve it alongside the short rib kalbi barbecue. And she would make that with a side of rice and all these different like side dishes that I loved. And that has always been like home for me. And it's like something I'll never get to eat again. But I always think of my mom and like how much care went into that meal every time I came home. It's just that meal that's like, I'll always be someone's baby, you know? Like that's like what that meal reminds me of. And if I could have that again for my last meal. That would be it.
Is that something that you've attempted to make?
It's just never the same. I mean, I make that kind of meal all the time, you know, but it's like you're a baby. Like when it's your mom making it for you, it's like, yeah. The food tastes different than when you make it for yourself and for other people. And I feel like that taste is like, you can never replicate it.
We're going to pause for just a moment, but when we come back, Michelle talks about how she learned to cook the Korean dishes that she grew up with. Have you been to Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula? If you are planning your spring and summer adventures like I have been, you're going to want to add the Kitsap Peninsula to your list. There are so many charming little waterfront towns like Paul's Bow and Bainbridge Island, lush forests for hiking, water trails for kayaking. There are breweries, wineries, restaurants, and farmers markets. And all of that is located west of Seattle, just across the Puget Sound. When I travel, I am always looking for places like this. Beautiful places where the locals go to vacation. And today I'm going to tell you about Port Orchard and Olalla, where you can rent a stand-up paddleboard, you can take a hike in Manchester State Park, taste some wines and see live music at Olalla Winery, and head down to the Port Orchard waterfront to do some shopping and have a delicious meal. Whether it's a day trip or a whole weekend, play and stay on the Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of Puget Sound. Go to visitkitsap.com/yourlastmeal. And Kitsap is K-I-T-S-A-P. If you like listening to Your Last Meal, you also might like my brand new TV show. It's called The Nosh with Rachel Bell, and there are brand new episodes every Friday in April. We get into everything from bagels, are there only good ones in New York City, to the ever-expanding, exciting world of non-alcoholic drinks, and lots of other fun stuff in between. Watch The Nosh from anywhere in the world at cascadepbs.org, or if you're in Washington State or BC, you can check it out on Channel 9 every Friday in April at 8:50 p.m. And to make it easy, I put a link in the show notes. Thanks, friends. After Michelle's mom died, she wanted to be comforted by the food she grew up with, the foods that her mother had always cooked for her. So she did what most modern people do when they need to learn how to do something. She went to YouTube.
Hi, everybody. What are you cooking? These days, when I go outside, I feel chilly, so cold. What can we do to make our house so cozy and warm? That kind of food I'm going to make today. This is soft tofu stew, sundubu jjigae. Everybody's favorite.
That's where she discovered Mongchi, a Korean home cook with 5.5 million followers who teaches her viewers how to cook classic Korean dishes. The New York Times once called her YouTube's Korean Julia Child.
I mean, it was pretty much like the day after her funeral that I looked online for a recipe for doenjang jjigae, which is like a fermented soybean stew that's really common staple in many Korean households. And my aunt and my cousin were visiting, and I just wanted to do something nice for them. And so I looked online for a recipe and found Mongchi, who's a YouTube vlogger who's really sort of demystified the Korean cooking process for a lot of Americans and, you know, English speakers. And she very much taught me how to cook a lot of the Korean dishes.
And then you got to meet Mongchi. I saw that you, when you were doing the show for Vice, you actually got to interview her, right?
I had written this essay called Love, Loss, and Kimchi that was largely about how grateful I was to her for helping me through this really difficult time in my life, and how much joy she brought back into my household. And, you know, when it was published in Glamour, she called me. She saw that it had won Glamour magazine's Essay of the Year in 2016, and she gave me a call and was like, I'm just so proud of you. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like you're, you know, digital mom or something. And then so we kind of like kept in touch. And when I did that Mongchi series, I invited her to be a part of it. And then the day after was my 30th birthday. And she was like, oh, come to my house. I'll like make you dinner. And so I actually went to her house for dinner for my 30th birthday. And she made an amazing spread of like bulgogi and like her incredible homemade kimchi. And yeah, she's been really, really generous and kind to me.
So what were some of the foods that helped you grieve? You know, you wanted to make these foods that your mom had cooked for you.
You know, shortly after my mom passed, I made a dish called chatjuk, which is pine nut porridge that my mom was eating a lot during her illness. And so when I discovered Mangchi, one of the first videos I was compelled to create was her recipe for chatjuk. I think that it felt like this real sort of psychological undoing of some of the shame that I felt of how I'd maybe let my mom down and my like failure to figure out how to nourish her in a way. So that was one of the first things I made. My mom's like kalbi recipe and kimchi jjigae and like all these kind of staples were followed pretty shortly after because my mom always made those things for me and I needed to figure out how to make them for myself.
According to the book, like it was never exactly like your mom's. Have you kind of been at peace at having your own flavors that are kind of your signatures now?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone has that feeling where like nothing is as good as mom's in a way. And I so miss taste of my mom's food. But yeah, I mean, I guess they're like homages to her to her cooking in a way. And you know, that's the best I can do.
This does not exist in my family, but maybe you're from the Midwest or from the South, and you're lucky enough to have one of those little recipe boxes where your mom or your grandma wrote in loopy cursive handwriting all of their recipes for biscuits or tuna casserole. Or maybe you have some of your family's recipes because they were printed in one of those spiral-bound church cookbooks. But if you're the child of an immigrant, there is not usually that kind of record-keeping. You hear these stories all the time from the children of parents who are from Asia or the Middle East or from South America, where the kid asks their parents how to make a dish, and the parent is super nonchalant about it and just says, a dash of this, a dash of that. There's no measurements, and it's really hard to get the dish to taste how you want it to taste. Well, that story was very familiar for Chef Melissa Miranda, whose dad immigrated to Seattle from the Philippines in the 1970s.
My whole childhood, I was surrounded by Filipino food because of my dad. But then there was this kind of shame around it, you know, and I'd take my lunches to school and I would be embarrassed because, you know, it smelled.
Melissa went to culinary school in Italy. She lived in Italy for 6 years before moving to New York. And then a few years ago, she came back to Seattle, where she was cooking at an Italian restaurant. When she came home, she reconnected with a Vietnamese friend named Alan Vu.
There was this kind of light bulb moment. Alan came to me and was like, Mel, we're never going to learn our parents' food unless we like shadow them, you know, and like there's no cookbooks to really be able to familiarize ourselves with the dishes that aren't in the restaurants. What about the stuff they cook at home? And he had spent time with one of his friend's moms growing up in high school, who was an incredible cook. And so we set it up that I would shadow her and kind of just take notes and observe as best as I could to recreate these dishes that she was sharing with us.
But here's the catch. This woman didn't speak English, so Melissa had to really pay attention. Melissa and Alan teamed up with a couple other friends to create a series of pop-up dinners called No Cookbooks Allowed, where they cook the dishes they learned by watching various immigrant home cooks and taking notes. Before she started doing these pop-up dinners, Melissa had pretty much always cooked Western food in restaurants.
So when I came back to Seattle, I had realized how much the city had changed. I've been gone for almost 8 years and I kind of just realized, you know, especially driving through Beacon Hill, where my father immigrated to, like all the Filipino restaurants that we had gone to were gone. It just kind of was this moment where like, how can we bring education of Filipino food, of flavors, of dishes, etc., if it doesn't exist here. We wanted to showcase that there is so much more than just, you know, adobo or pancit. Like, there's so many more flavors for you to understand. We made it a point always to write the menus in Tagalog because there's such an education and learning point for folks. You know, like, it takes years, you know, but we're familiar with, you know, Vietnamese dishes and Japanese dishes and Thai dishes, we can say them and pronounce it in the language, but like we don't even know what that is in Tagalog, you know? And so that was kind of a big point for me in starting the pop-ups.
The pop-ups were super popular. So a couple years ago, Melissa opened a Filipino restaurant in Beacon Hill called Musong, which is named after her dad.
My dad actually immigrated to Seattle in the 70s. He drove a black Mustang and the T fell off, so he became Musong. His group of friends that he made here were, you know, all young Filipinos, and they all had nicknames themselves. So
One's name was like Val Afro because he had the biggest afro. One was Slay Pa'a, which means feet in Tagalog because he had big feet. And so my whole childhood in hanging out with them as well, because they were like my uncles. Anywhere we would be, whether it was the mall or the park or an event, you know, all I'd hear is Musang.
Before she opened the restaurant, Melissa took a 3-month trip to the Philippines to visit friends.
I was experiencing back pains and she was like, let's take you to the healer. And she was this powerful and older Filipino woman. Like, she was so small, but her hands were just like so large, and like just looking at them, you kind of knew there was something really incredible about her. You know, she was doing work and then she looked at my arm, and I have an owl tattoo on my arm, and actually I don't speak the dialect, and she just was like asking my friend, she's like, why does she have a owl? She should have a musang tattoo. So musang in Tagalog means wild cat. And it was just this moment where I was like, wait, what? Like, what did she say? And the fact that that came out of nowhere, it was this just kind of moment of like, maybe that's where we need to go.
Melissa is actually reading Michelle's book, Crying in H Mart, right now. When I met up with her for the interview, she actually pulled the book out of her bag. So I wanted to know if she has a strong connection to a grocery store, just like Michelle does with H Mart.
So in Beacon Hill, there's a grocery store called Phu Ly. It's actually Vietnamese owned, but it carries mostly just Filipino ingredients. And I actually grew up going there as a child with my dad. After I'd moved away, I forgot about that place. And then when I moved to Beacon Hill, I found Phu Ly again. And there was that moment of like, I've been here before. And it was so beautiful. Like, they have this deli case full of Philippine food. And you're just like, oh my gosh, like, I remember the smells and like the aisles, and it looks exactly the same. And that place, I think, is so iconic to not just myself, but a lot of the Filipino families that still live on Beacon Hill.
At Musang, Melissa cooks the Philippine dishes a family might eat at home, but she uses modern techniques and seasonal local ingredients. Her entire staff is made up of young Filipinos, and she's very focused on making sure this food gets passed down to the next generations.
We started Musang Little Wildcats, which is a kids' cooking class. And so we came up with this idea of, like, wouldn't it be great if we had these classes where kids could eat food that they don't usually eat, like, you know, panse, adobo, other things. And then they'd eat the dinner with their parents, and it was super beautiful.
All right, so I've been talking to these women about foods that are meaningful in their lives, foods that connect them to their culture. But when we come back, Michelle reveals her favorite trashy snack. One of my favorite things to ask people, whether it's a guest on the show or someone I'm on a hike with, is what is your favorite trashy snack? And Michelle has a particularly good answer.
Oh, yeah. I really like Flaming Hot Cheetos with lemon juice. So I'll like pour a bag of Flaming Hot Cheetos and I'll like douse it with lemon juice and then I'll eat it with chopsticks. Almost like it's like cereal, you know.
Do you eat cereal with chopsticks?
I do not eat cereal with chopsticks, but I mean, like, it soaks up the liquid. It like takes on this like liquid coating in a way, you know. But my best friend growing up was like half Mexican, and her whole family ate this weird snack, and I really fell in love with it when I was a kid.
I think eating them with chopsticks though is so classy.
That's my addition. They used to just eat it with their hands, and then all of their like fingers would be like bright red all the time. And so I was like, oh, I'll use chopsticks, and that will keep me from getting messy.
And that was Michelle Zahner's last meal. Make sure and pick up a copy of her book, Crying in H Mart. I highly recommend you buy the book from a local independent bookseller trying to keep those guys open. I know it's easy to order it online from the big company, but we got to help out the little guys. All right, that's my little preaching section, but I want to tell you that I loved her book. And I highly recommend getting Korean takeout when you're going to read, because I ended up having to make a mad dash and go out and get Korean food because everything she describes in the book sounds so delicious. Oh, and Japanese Breakfast's new album, Jubilee, comes out on June 4th. Oh, one more question. So when I was in my early 20s, I was a music journalist, in quotes, for my, you know, independent weekly in my college town. And I was really bad at it. I asked the stupidest questions. And the question that I know now is the worst to ask. I'm going to ask you, which is, where does your band name come from? Which was like a question I asked every time. But I'm so curious because I love Japanese Breakfast and I lived in Japan, and so I would love to know where it came from.
Yeah, I guess I was just like young and stupid, and I just like, you know, this was before my mom got sick, and I became kind of like really fascinated with this Korean part of my identity, and it became a very confusing band name to have. But when I started the band, I was uploading all of my demos onto Tumblr, and I was like following a lot of like anime gif blogs. There was like an anime gif of Japanese Breakfast, and it just was like a really like soothing sort of like nostalgic image, you know, watching anime when I was a kid, and like so neat and soothing.
Thanks to Melissa Miranda, chef owner of Musang in Seattle's Beacon Hill neighborhood. You can find a link to make a reservation or order takeout in the show notes.
The restaurant was never meant to be about me. It was never meant to be just about my story. It was meant to honor, you know, those before us that have made sacrifices and their stories and their journeys.
Your Last Meal is produced by Laura Scott and me, theme music by Prom Queen. If you're not already, make sure you're subscribed to the show. That way you'll get the episodes as soon as they come out. Make sure to leave a review. Follow along on Instagram. Hello, Rachel Bell. That's B-E-L-L-E. I am Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal. This is crazy. And I am recording too. And speaking in a weird cadence. Okay. I was racing to finish your book because I just got it on Thursday and I have like half a chapter left. Up until this moment, I was like, I think I could finish it because it's so good. I love your book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.